welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound mixers, composers, VFX gurus, animators, and so many more. And boy, oh boy, we're running the gamut this week on BTL as we go from one end of the spectrum to the other as we take a look at writer-director Adam Egoyan's dramatic new thriller, Seven Veils, and everyone's favorite and loony Pig and Duck, Porky and Daffy, in writer-director Peter Brownguard's feature animated directorial debut, Looney Tunes, The Day the Earth Blew Up. I love both of these films, and I think you will too, especially Looney Tunes. First up today is my exclusive interview with one of my longtime favorite directors, Adam Egoyan. Some of his prior films are The Captive, Devil's Knot, Chloe, and Remember, all of which are wonderful, captivating, and intriguing. I have spoken with Adam on, I think, all but a couple of his films over the years, so it's a joy to reconnect with him about Seven Veils. I will see anything and everything that he does, and I'm thrilled that he now presents us with Seven Veils, an exquisite blend of cinema and theater, opera to be specific, that will have you mesmerized by the visual beauty and intensity of the film and leave you breathless with the power of the story, which is built around the acclaimed opera Salome. Written and directed by Adam Egoyan, Seven Veils stars Amanda Seyfried, who reunites with Adam after their 2015 film Chloe, along with Rebecca Lydiard, Douglas Smith, Mark O'Brien, Vanessa Antoine, Amber Braid, Michael Kuffer, Radecki. Based on the biblical tale of Salome, and those of you that know your Bible will know this story, which has been told in countless ways over the years, most notably as a 19th century opera by Richard Strauss and written by Oscar Wilde. Adam has taken his own love for the tale, which he has directed on the stage numerous times since 1996. Yes, Adam just doesn't direct film. He's a stage director as well. And he now explores what a production of Salome would mean in our current culture. This led him to write Seven Veils about, it revolves around a remount of Salome that he filmed at the same time the opera was being performed on stage by the Canadian Opera Company in 2023, using the opera singers and opera cast of the Salome stage production in the film. With the opera at its core, Adam wrote a modern tale around that and the opera production itself, as we meet theater director Janine, played by Seyfried, who re-enters the opera world to stage her former mentor's most famous work. Haunted by dark and disturbing memories from her past, Janine allows her repressed trauma to color the present as her personal and professional lives begin to unravel. And that often is a theme that runs in many of Adam's films. Visually stunning, seductive, sensual, even jarring, Adam beautifully blends cinema with theatricality. So take a listen as we break down the Seven Veils from creation to cinematography to editing to score in my exclusive interview with writer-director Adam Egoyan. Hi, Adam.
How are you?
I am fine. It is so good to speak with you again. I think it's been almost 10 years since we last got to talk.
Well, nice to speak with you again. Thank you for your support.
We were on a roll there for a while. Every year we were chatting multiple times. I think our last films were Remember and then Somewhere Beautiful when I talked with you and Albert.
You know, Albert's passed, right?
I know. It's just the passage of time. Just, it's amazing how fast it goes by. because it doesn't seem that long ago, but I'm so happy to talk with you now about Seven Veils. This film is so you. It is seductive. It's stylized. It's rich and lush in the visual tonal bandwidth. It's cinematic and theatrical. I love how dark and twisted it is from a psychological standpoint as we go down Janine's rabbit hole into her psyche as she kind of descends into her own madness. It just brilliant on every level, Adam. I love it.
Thank you so much.
I love it. Because you love Salome, the play so much. I have to wonder, when did you decide, hey, this would be really good to turn into a film with a fresh take on the play itself?
Really, not until this latest remount. So it was originally staged in 1996 between Exotica and Sweet Hereafter, and it was like a real... it was my first experience directing an opera, and it was a real hit. Like, it really shocked people because of what I'd done with the dance, because I took away the dance and I just put in this flashback sequence that I constructed with projections and shadows, and it was super violent, and people kind of, like, were really shocked by it, and people left the theater, but also kept coming back. Like, it was, so it's been remounted a number of times, and actually, I was sort of just remembering when I was after I'd shot Sweet Hereafter in 97, in the winter of 97, I was in Houston Grand remounting this while I was editing Sweet Hereafter. So that's how long it's been in my sort of like orbit. And when I found out that the CEO of the Canadian Opera Company was remounting it in 2023, it was like, oh my God, like, okay, so... First of all, it's very unusual that something that has that sort of legacy where it just, you know, it lasts for that long. But I also felt that creatively, like, we're not living in the same space. Like culture, our society and culture has changed. And there are all these other considerations. And what does Salome mean, you know, in 2023? But I couldn't change this production. Like, it's sort of embedded in the set, and all that tone is not going to change because we don't have the time or the budget. But I thought, well, then maybe I can write something around it, which then puts it into this context, like kind of frames it in a certain way. And once I had that idea, it was like, okay, so then what about this character who's coming back to remount it? And Janine began to kind of develop, and I began to think of, well, what if she was a young woman? What if she had this tour de pair with the original director? And what if he had passed and he had, you know, like said in his will that she must be remounted? And we begin to understand that a lot of the opera, this interpretation was inspired by her stories. And I thought that, okay, then I was on a roll. I thought, okay, this is really cool because I can then... I was taking this woman from the house that she's living in, like, and a marriage which is, you know, like not doing great, and also the house that she was raised in, and there's obviously all sorts of dysfunction happening there, but then put her in this big public house, an opera house, and suddenly she thinks she's going to be liberated from these places, but actually she realizes there are all these expectations and limitations placed on her, and agendas that are not her own, and she begins to feel all the things that she felt in these other houses, and that begins to drive her, as you said, she begins to have some sort of a breakdown, and she becomes totally fixated as she's watching the archival tape, because that's what you do when you're remounting the show, that there is this erotic charge in the original that she's not able to actually summon. And she begins to, that begins to drive her crazy, you know, like, and actually, you know, she begins to behave in ways that are completely out of bounds, really. So she's, a fascinating character. And then I, you know, having had this really great experience with Amanda on Chloe, and promising that we'd work together and find something to do in the future, she came to mind. But then, you know, there's two major hurdles. One is, this had to happen while the production was on stage here in Toronto at the COC. We had no flexibility. at the end of the production. Can't bring them back. Can't bring the set back. But then Amanda had just won her Emmy for Dropout, so you know she was super busy. But miraculously, she was available and she wanted to do it, and she just brought her best. You know, like everything I hoped she would bring, she brought like in abundance, and just you know, love this character. And it was very stressful at this moment where you realize I've never been as hemmed in. Like it has to happen, and getting. You know, like it was crazy, and there were all sorts of, you know, other issues. Like it was still COVID. It was still, you know, like so many things could have gone wrong, but it happened. And I'm still like 2 years. This was 2 years ago that we shot it, and I'm just so thankful that it emerged.
Well, I noticed, you know, we get into the third act, and we see the conductor, and as he puts down the baton, he pulls up his COVID mask. So I had an idea right then of when you shot this. But something that really strikes me, as I mentioned, this is not only theatrical, it's very cinematic. So I'm so thrilled you've got Paul back as your cinematographer. Can you even make a film without Paul? I don't think so. The two of you are magic.
We are so lucky because, you know, we wanted it to feel like the stage set, like that it has this kind of expressionistic feel, but you know, and we wanted that to be reflected in the light choices and the camera movements and compositions. And because, you know, we have now, you know, the Met Live, we knew what we didn't want it to look like, right? You know, so it had to feel cinematic. It couldn't feel like a live, you know, production of and really, you don't even have to like opera or know opera to see the film. It's a work environment, but we knew that the work environment had to have this feeling of the set. We needed to extend that feeling through the whole movie. I mean, he has a Strauss score, so we knew we were going to use that music, but we also had to extend that to our film score as well, somehow.
Well, and this is where it's so important that you also are working with Michael again. And that's one of my big notes that I made watching this. I love Michael's score and how it blends with the music of the opera. It is seamless. And it's very evocative in the emotion that you're picking up. It's not as intense as the operatic music, but it really serves as a wonderful undercurrent that ebbs and flows with Janine's emotions, really. I'm just so thrilled with that musicality. What were your conversations with Michael like for what you wanted musically?
Richard Strauss uses like every instrument in the book, but we had to find some sound that he didn't use, and we sort of like were drawn to the vibes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing we hear in the film is a vibraphone. So that's not in the Strauss score. So it immediately it creates this other sort of layer. So even if we were using motifs, it was separated from the Strauss score because of the sonic universe of that sound. And then there are so many. It's not like a Wagner motif. Like Strauss is coloring every word that Oscar Wilde comes up with a particular shape and sound. So there's a wealth of stuff to draw from in terms of what Strauss is doing and extending that into Michael's themes. And so it's a very respectful score, but it also creates its own sort of motif, especially when we're going to the childhood. Because her child images are really about the Oscar Wilde text separate from the music.
Right.
So we need that, we can create this other sort of space. And that comes up, you know, quite often. And then we also knew that at the end, like what we were both excited by was what happens if you take the singing out of the Strauss score, and you get what you have at the end of the film, which is, it sounds like this crazy like prototype of what all these Hollywood composers from Germany were singing. It's just his score. And when you know that, again, we can contrast that with the vibes coming in for the end credits. Like, it really is a whole kind of a study of how do you orchestrate and what's the palette you have, especially when you're working with a composer who uses what you think is the full palette, but there's obvious instruments that are not obvious, like there's sounds that he did not incorporate, and that's, you start from there.
And it's funny that as the score winds down at the end, as I was listening to it, I was thinking Franz Waxman.
Well, there you go. I was rewatching Rebecca, right? Because I was going, people ask me, well, you never see Charles, right? Like, I was going, yeah, that's, and I was going, what other films is there a major character that you don't see? And I was thinking Rebecca. Because you don't want to see Rebecca, right? You know, like, that's the whole point. And so, but he scored that, right? And amazing composer.
Yeah, and this is why your partnerships, your collaborations with Michael and with Paul are so important. Because for all the flavor and texture that Michael gives us musically, as does Richard Strauss, Paul's cinematography. I love how the visual grammar that the two of you developed. As you said, you did not shoot this like, we're going in, we got five cameras placed, and we're just filming a stage production. No, this is alive. This is vibrant.
Yeah, the beauty that I trust all, anything to do with light, I just trust to Paul, because he understands light in a way that I don't. When it comes to movement and composition, I'm really specific about what I want the camera to frame and how I want it to move. But in terms of how I want it to be lit, I just trust him. You know, like, it's funny, and this came to me when I was, when we were shooting on film, Adjuster, and there was a scene that to my eye just looked like it was, like, not lit well enough or something, like, he said, no, this is going to saturate the blacks and it's going to look amazing. And he was right. And from that time in 1991, I've just shut up about light. I don't say anything about the light. Even now that I'm looking at it in a monitor, like, I trust him. Suggest something like in terms of a camera move, because you know that's something that I'm feeling a certain way, but I'm feeling it because I know he's going to make it look a certain way, and so it's a very, it's the same thing with Michael, right? A lot of these camera moves are anticipating a way I know Michael's going to then score it, right? So I'm trusting the move to be enhanced by a sensibility that I know Michael's going to bring, and I'm thinking of his contribution as I'm actually moving the camera. So, yes, these are really cherished relationships.
You know, and something I love that you and Paul do with the visual grammar, I mean, his lighting, it is impeccable. And I love the contrast that we get with the lighting. But with the camera movement and the way you have blocked this out, you mentioned, you know, the house. When Janine is in the house growing up, the house, you know, now where her mother lives, the opera house. But I love how we get so much on where the frame, it's opened out, it's wide in the opera house. And even on stage, it's wider than in her home, in the childhood, or where her mother lives, or even in the house that she's living in that belongs to an art patron, where we see her in like one tiny room. There's a great difference there of the intimacy and the claustrophobia, the claustrophobic nature of her mind, where everything is closed in, versus as it's opening out in the opera.
And filtered through this screen, right? I mean, so it's interesting that you have the wide screen format, but then you have the aspect ratio of the computer screen, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how these images are actually being transmitted. So there are these moments like when she's imagining, when she's looking at something on screen, and then it lifts into the film image, and you know that passage is really pronounced, especially you know when you are factoring in this. Very kind of expressionistic sort of image of having her reflection in the screen, which is like, you know, like, it's, yes, there are reflections, but we don't notice them as we're talking to someone, but digitally we can, you know, using special effects, we can kind of mat in her face on the screen, so we see her at all times, and it just heightens everything, right?
Yeah.
So the idea is to have it heightened, and aspect ratio and the actual, you know, as you know, like negative space is incredibly important in any composition.
Negative space. I love negative space. But I love it, but I love when it's used appropriately. And you always use it appropriately, Adam. There's never a question about that. What did you and Paul shoot the home movie, the vintage footage on? Because that is just so stunning. And that contrast that we get, that here again, it feeds into Janine's obsessiveness and her descent.
Yeah, so that was not shot on digital format. We shot it on mini DV, which was an analog process that uses, it was a particular texture, and we were looking at the timeline, and it still would have been what he would have been shooting on, and it means that you get this very different texture than if we were, you know, if it was like if you're shooting it on a cell phone, or I mean, so I think it kind of roots it in a time. Like whenever I'm using technologies, I'm always aware of how they root the story in a particular time. Sometimes, like let's say in an early film like Family Viewing, where the home videos were color, and when we shot that film in 1986, that wouldn't have been likely, but you know, it's sort of explained in the film that the father who owns the camera works for the company who makes them and had a prototype or something. I mean, I kind of knew that in a few years it wouldn't be an issue, but you know, and it's a bit like also in Adoration, like with these group Skypes, which look like, you know, like what we do now, but at the time it was kind of futuristic speaking parts as well. You know, like you have to anticipate where the technology is going to be, but on the other hand, heritage technologies which are rooted in a specific time, like mini DV, like, you know, if it was like regular 8 film as opposed to Super 8 film, or they all these formats have their own texture, and it's beautiful to see it. You know, I mean, I used to use this a lot in my films. It's become now a little bit antiquated because, you know, I remember when I watched Caché by Michael Haneke, and I went, oh, I guess there's no longer a difference between digital and film. Like, basically, the two they flow into each other. But there was this point when I started making films when the two were very separate. So I wanted to go back to that feeling with this film, where I was able to go full-frame video, and you would know that it's a different medium.
Mm-hmm. Right? I absolutely love the home movie look, and because it looks like the faded Polaroids of the 70s, or, you know, the Instamatic Polaroid, not even the Polaroid 600, the ones before that. And it added so much depth, emotional depth, to almost a metaphor between Salome and Janine.
Yeah.
And their history and their relationship with their father, or in the case of Salome, stepfather.
You're using the visual palette to kind of express something about what the characters are feeling, and you're giving yourself license because the technology allows that, right? Like, you wouldn't make that bold a choice if you weren't actually seeing the characters actually making images of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've got to ask you about editing. You're working with David Warnsby on this one. The editing creates such tension. And I love how you and David hold on shots to almost certain ones where we're just studying Janine, where she's not saying anything, but you see something is boiling, something is agitating her, something is about to erupt, and you just hold to the point of uncomfortableness. It is brilliant, Adam. It is brilliant. What was the editing process like on this one?
Inspired by having the most extraordinary, you know, like actress. I mean, I just felt, it's funny we're talking about this because our son said, you know, do you remember that moment in David Lynch's Twin Peaks where Amanda, there's this kind of signature shot where she just throws her head back in a car and the camera just folds on her for like this crazy amount of time, and I watch it on YouTube and it's like, oh wow, yeah, that's only she could actually allow a director to make that choice, right? Like, it just, she's like I see her as like a young Betty Davis, right? You know, like she has that crazy intensity, and her eyes are just so magnetic. Like they're just like they have this, and yet it's sincere. Like you have a whole portal into her emotional space, and that's like it's a. It inspires these choices. You can't hold those shots unless, you know, you feel you're giving back something to the viewer.
Yeah.
You're giving that warrants that type of attention.
Yeah, you have to have a reason, something there for us to fixate on. And Amanda's performance, Amanda does that in spades with this one. But you have a definitive pacing here. Was it difficult for you and David to find the pace of this one?
Well, I mean, some of it is determined by the length of these shots. There's no coverage. So it's mm-hmm. like the camera is moving through space, and then it's like, you know, so you're, that governs the rhythm, right? So it feels like... and then you're also anticipating where you want music to be, and we're using music. It's the most difficult thing to talk about because the rhythm is just innate, you know, like you don't really, you can see there are problems, there are moments where you might want to tighten rhythm or you might want to loosen it up, but the governing rhythm of a film is a very, very mysterious thing that really emanates from the way these scenes live in the director's imagination, as opposed to an industrial film where you're shooting it all, you know, conventional coverage, and you can manipulate it any way you want. But there's also a pace to the way, you know, people are thinking of things. Like, you know, like in the podcast, when the props master, Nakia, is interviewing Amanda, and Amanda doesn't answer a question. Like, she's asked about, you know, what was Charles like, and she doesn't answer. And by not having, like, not cutting back to Rebecca, kind of understanding she doesn't want to answer, but holding, then you get the feeling that Rebecca is uncomfortable, as opposed to, you know, just using the information that, you know, she's not going to answer that. Do you know what I mean? It's like you're more embedded in the emotional place of the characters. Even if it makes you uncomfortable, like I do that a lot in my films, I guess. I mean, by observing something, just watching it, and especially in this film, where you know the issue she keeps bringing back is that you know she's watched too much. The reason she doesn't go on the stage at the end is that she doesn't want to be seen anymore. She doesn't want to be watched. You know, so but we are watching her all the time. So there's mm-hmm. a paradox there, right? And you want to. You want to kind of be aware of that in your construction of the scene.
Mm-hmm. On every level, Adam, this is just absolutely wonderful. Particularly, even your supporting cast, the non-opera performers, but your supporting cast, Rebecca is wonderful as Clea, very interesting character there. And then when we get into our the producers and the politics that they want to play, fascinating. You do not shy away from that. You incorporate that, and all of the subject matter that they're looking at just incorporates. It just feeds right back into Janine. And it's just, it's a jigsaw puzzle that is perfectly put together.
Well, I mean, look, it starts also with this image of like this bridge between two different worlds, right? This creative bridge between what's on stage and what's in the public, right? And in this place, you know, we see her, it's the first time we see her, she walks onto this bridge and she makes reference to it, and it's like this, like, where you're allowed, where your creativity and your imagination is allowed to find expression, and this idea that it's latently there in this building, in this house, but it's ultimately at the discretion of the people who govern it, you know, like any sort of institution, and, I think that's what, you know, she begins to feel oppressed by. And so, and that's, I'm basing this on things that have happened and I've seen and I've heard, mm-hmm. you know, and people behave the way you might expect them to. Like, you know, I think even like when, you know, like something as obvious as the sexual assault, you know, like you think if you report that to the people in power that they would react a certain way, but that doesn't always quite work out. And so, then, okay, what then? What? You still need justice, so you try and find your own way of restoring justice, restorative justice, and that might not be the right decision, but I always want it to be palatable, like emotionally, why these people are making, you know, like right or wrong choices. Like it's part of our, it's part of what creates tension and drama. But the way the camera observes it, and what it, the camera's telling you about how to see this, and to not make a judgment, or leaving that to the viewer is at the core of what I'm trying to do with cinema. Like it's what excites me. It's like to create these circumstances. And you know, in this case too, you have the most outrageous action. I mean, Salome, I mean, the reason why that story persists is that it's still shocking what she demands. But you know, starting with the production, I wanted to question like what why would she do that? Like what is in her background that would lead to that decision? And this, you know, this production, stage production, has an answer to that. And I think, you know, in terms of what the decisions are that these individual characters are making, you know, I want that to be part of the dialogue as well. I want people to ask themselves and have conversations about that after the film.
This film will definitely spark conversation, all of it good, because
thank you so much.
You have just, Adam, you've done an amazing job once again.
Thank you so much.
And I can't wait to see what you do next.
Oh, well, we'll see. They're tough. These films are tough to make. They really are.
Yeah.
Like, it used to be a lot easier. But I'm really grateful it got made, and thank you so much. I'm so happy it's making its way to theaters. That's so important.
I'm thrilled. And thank you for taking time to talk with me after all this time.
Yeah. And thank you for all the support for so long. Thank you.
And that was my exclusive interview with Atom Egoyan discussing Seven Veils. And it is now in theaters on the big screen nationwide. Anybody that watched the Oscars and you heard Sean Baker reminding people, theater, cinemas, this is the perfect film to see on the big screen because of its beauty and the visual intensity of it. The production values are just off the charts. So I encourage you to catch Seven Veils if you can. Now, switching gears now, we go from seductive and sensual to sarcastic, satiric, slapstick, and pure unadulterated joy with Porky Pig and Daffy Duck in Looney Tunes, The Day the Earth Blew Up, and my exclusive conversation with writer, director, animator Peter Braungart. This is everything you could want and more, not just in an animated film, a hand-drawn 2D animated film, to be precise, but in animation in general, and particularly in the world of Looney Tunes. Timeless and iconic, this buddy comedy starring Porky Pig and Daffy Duck marks the first fully animated feature-length film in Looney Tunes history. This is big. This is big news, folks. The legends of Warner Brothers' Termite Terrace would be so proud of what Peter and his team have done with Looney Tunes, The Day the Earth Blew Up. As to be expected, Porky Pig and Daffy Duck are the most unlikely heroes you can think of. And as it turns out, they are Earth's only hope when their antics at a local bubblegum factory uncover a secret alien mind control plot. Faced with cosmic odds, the two are determined to save their town and the world. That is, if they don't drive each other totally loony in the process. Voice acting is perfection thanks to the work of acclaimed actors Eric Bauza, who voices Porky and Daffy, Candy Milo, who voices Petunia Pig, Peter McNichol, Wayne Knight, yes, Newman, and Lorraine Newman, which helped bring the laugh-out gags, vibrant visuals, and beloved characters to life. Listen as Peter talks about the animation and dialogue going hand in hand. And it boils down to what came first, the pig or the duck egg. And working with 11 writers and animators, the writers are animators, animators are writers in many of these cases, to develop the emotion through drawing, dialogue, and voicing, the classic hand-drawn visuals paying homage to the past, including many classic films. There's a great visual reference there to the very first film I ever saw in my life when I was 4 years old, 1925's Nosferatu, while adding some contemporary notes, melding genres, music and score, getting a green light from Warner Brothers to even make the film, and of course, Peter's own learning curve with his first feature after hundreds of Looney Tunes shorts. We have a lot of fun and a lot of laughs in this conversation. So take a listen and enjoy. Well, Peter, I can't tell you. I have been waiting since the Animationist Film Festival to talk to you about this film. I am so in love with this film.
Thank you so much.
Just phenomenal. And to see it on the big screen at the Chinese was just, there's nothing like it. It is, number one, Porky Pig has been my favorite Looney Tunes character since I was a little girl. So we're going back 67 years.
Yeah, it's a great character. I mean, he's the first Looney Tunes star of all time.
Yes, he is. So to see a feature film, number one, to see a Looney Tunes feature film in 2D animation, that in and of itself is...
Weird, right?
Oh, my God. It's like Christmas morning and opening the packages. But yeah, that in and of itself. And then for it to be about Porky and Daffy, just phenomenal. And then you give us this incredible story that melds genres. You have all kinds of homage to classic films, classic cartoons. I love when we meet the invader and you've got the whole shadow look that goes right back to Max Schreck's Nosferatu, 1925.
Cabinet of Dr. Caligari is one of my favorites. That's very reminiscent of that too, like that German Expressionist.
Yes.
Sort of shadow and very slang stuff, yeah.
Very much so. And then you beautifully meld the truth and the honesty and purity of the 1940s, 50s Looney Tunes with the visual aesthetic, the story aesthetic, the comedy aesthetic. But then you update it and you add modern elements there like Boba and cell phones and everybody, you see something, nobody's talking to each other. They're holding up their cell phones to take pictures of it. So you had but you didn't.
I go to a concert and you got Ozzy Osbourne or somebody on stage and everyone's filming it. Like, well, you're right there.
Yeah,
man.
Try watching it. You know, it's like, gee, I mean, when I went to concerts when I was a teenager and even in my 20s and 30s, and there were no cell phones, cameras weren't allowed, they'd certainly, you know.
Same here, yeah.
So,
it's wild, weird way of adjusting life, it's crazy, yeah.
And you meld all of this just so perfectly, perfectly.
Oh, that's so nice of you to say. It's really, really kind of you to say, thank you.
I was thinking, oh, they're really going to update it and, you know, they're going to really modernize, and you didn't. This is classic to its core.
Yeah.
And pure and wonderful.
I was definitely conscious. I mean, we were going in, Looney Tunes is on the Mount Rushmore of not only animation history and animation as an animator and a filmmaker, but film in general and entertainment in general. Great reverence for this stuff. I take it very seriously. We all do on the crew, and I don't think I would be involved with something that is that. I'm not interested in trying to change what's great. I want to just facilitate it and work with it and work with these characters and make the characters shine. Because, yeah, I think it's been done wrong, and I think there's different ways, different opinions on what they think needs to happen with modernizing stuff, but I feel like my whole thing was like, we're satirizing, Looney Tunes satirized the world, then we're just going to do that, and we're going to do that in a tasteful, funny way. We're only going to satirize, and we're only going to keep a joke if the joke continues to be funny, and that it's about a cultural foundation. Like, I didn't want to do a joke on the latest pop song that's hitting the chart, because I don't know if that's going to be around in 20 years, but I'm pretty sure Starbucks is going to be around, or dealing with a coffee clerk,
mm-hmm.
you know, or a rideshare app
you know, that kind of stuff. And social media is not going anywhere. So I knew that I wanted to satirize, and we wanted to satirize sort of those cultural things, to sort of keep it modern and feel fresh and not feel like you're being the flavor of the week and trying to change Looney Tunes to something that it's not.
And of course, bubblegum will be around forever. So
yes, I hope so. Bubblegum is pretty awesome.
It truly is.
So I get to yell at my kids sometimes to stop chewing it so much, but it's I love bubblegum.
Just look at it this way. They're developing their jaw muscles.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. So
good in moderation, right? Everything's good in moderation.
So I've got to ask you, because I know Warner Brothers, the powers that be, came to you and others, and it's like contemplating a long-form Looney Tunes. Number one, how shocking was that to have them actually come to you and say, hey, you got any ideas for a long-form Looney Tunes? And then, and then for you to put something together and actually pitch a story?
Yeah.
How surprising, and for them to greenlight it. How surprising was this?
Well, it's always surprising to me that I get to do any of this stuff, to be honest with you. But, initially when they asked me if I had any thoughts about that or any ideas and wanted me to pitch anything, my initial gut reaction was, it can't be done. I didn't think these characters exist in short form, they work, their comedy dynamics work in short form, I don't know how you do it. But then I kept thinking about it, and this is how I do with everything. I initially have an idea or a thought. I always need time. I was just talking to somebody today, and they're like, you always need a little bit of time to sort of figure it out. And I go, yeah, I do. I need to, like, play it out in my head a couple of times. So I started thinking about it, and I kept going, like, well, maybe I'm thinking about approaching this a different way. Like, because I'm affected by people's attempts in the past of having to do stuff with these characters in long form. And I thought to myself, I go, well, I tried to think of some comparables out there of films that are loony or crazy. Mel Brooks movies, Abbott Costello movies, Peter Sellers movies, Dumb and Dumber, Farley Brother movies, stuff like that, that really obviously were influenced by Looney Tunes, right? So I'm like, well, what if it's that, right? What if you think of it that way? And what if you don't try to do an ensemble cast? And then I just said, well, what is the movie I want to see? What do I want to sit down with? A big piece, box of popcorn and soda and go, this is the Looney Tunes, this is what I want to see. And I feel like that's, as a filmmaker and as a storyteller and an entertainer, I think that's important to do, is to sit down. And I've heard Peter Jackson say that and other people that I look up to, storytellers that I look up to. And I think that's really important. I think it's important to sit down and go, well, what do I want to see? And if they don't want to, you don't sell it, you don't go for your pitch, well, I guess I'm not seeing it, cause, you know, but that's what I want to make, right? That's what I can get into. It's a lot of work to make this stuff. It takes a long time. So it was surprising. And it was surprising that I went in and I said, look, I want to make an Abbott Costello meets Frankenstein or an Ed Wood Looney Tunes movie, sci-fi genre movie. And I don't want the whole cast. I want it to be about Porky and Daffy. I don't want it to be about, because to be honest, Porky and Daffy don't sell t-shirts. Bugs sells t-shirts. Tweety Bird sells t-shirts. Tasmanian Devil sells t-shirts and that stuff. So it's not appealing to the company as like a push. So I'm like, I'm going to make the weirdo Looney Tunes movie. And went for it. And that really, his credit is to Warner Bros. Animation and Sam Register in particular. He is a torchbearer of these characters, and we're lucky to have him as the president of the company and pushing for this stuff. He knows how important these characters are, and he's trying to keep them alive, and I think that's a great thing. So, but yeah, they went for it, and at that time it was booming. The business was booming, streaming was booming. We're just I did the official pitch and green light basically a year into the pandemic. I think it was spring of 2021. And we got greenlit, we went into production.
Wow. And with this production, because storyboarding and writing go hand in hand if you're going to do animation right. And with Looney Tunes, so much of, especially when you're doing 2D, because of the personal touch, and I think you get much more of a tactile, emotional response when with 2D animation versus computer-generated, because it gives you more emotion. But that emotion and that fluidity of movement with each frame of a character, that also dictates a lot of your writing, because
you're 100% right. Actions tell stories, and that's action, right? Movement tells stories.
Uh-huh.
Action tells stories. Action is character, right? So I see what you're saying. Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's why cartoony animation and Looney Tunes, especially Looney Tunes style animation, has to be written in storyboard form with storyboard artists and cartoonists at the helm, in my opinion.
And that gives you a very specific cinematic language for this film. Because you can tell, it's like when things are blowing up, when things are exploding, when Daffy is going totally bonkers, or loony, as you have worked the word loony into the dialogue in at least 6 places that I counted,
yeah,
probably
yeah.
more, including breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah.
So I love how the writing and the dialogue feel like they're feeding off the antics of Porky and Daffy and Petunia
yeah.
and our invader. And it begs the question, because you have 11 different writers on this film.
Right.
So what was this process like? And you've got more storyboard artists than that and animators.
So the reason we have 11 was those 11 on there, 2 of which are proper writers. They
mm-hmm.
don't draw. But the other 9 are board artists that write and draw.
Okay.
So, and I fought for it. The studio usually doesn't give credit to board artists as writers, but I asked them and I went to bat. It was a big discussion, but to their credit, and I got to say, to Steve Hillenburg's credit, God rest his soul, he gave his writers, and Hollywood is always their favorite word, the lawyers in Hollywood's favorite word is precedence, right?
Yeah.
So there's a precedent of this. So the legal precedent is that Steve Hillenburg gave his writer, his board artist, writer credit on the first SpongeBob movie. And I was able to go, well, why can't we do it if they did it? And it was just enough to think to let me do it. And I kind of had to make a legal argument. I had to go, well, here's the script, and it's a good script, and it got the movie sold, but it's not the movie. So who wrote all the stuff that's in the movie, right? Who did that?
Mm-hmm.
We already decided that we moved on from the script, but we rewrote it. So we're not going to give who wrote it. Tell me who wrote it, right? That's really the question. And you kind of have no legs. You have no legs, you know? We literally showed them the screen pages, and then we showed them the animatic, and we go, well, who did this then? If you're not going to give them credit, you don't give credit out. You have to give credit out. So very important to me. I came from that side of things. I was a board artist at Cartoon Network on Chowder and other shows at your time. And those are the same things. You get an outline. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't work. And you got to put that episode on your back, and you got to make it work. And you have to rewrite it and rewrite every word that comes out of the character's mouth, every joke, making the jokes play. And this, I'm not discrediting screenwriters. They're wonderful, and it's super important, and they are such a genesis of film and storytelling. But for cartoons and making it play right, you kind of need that hybrid. It's a sort of a special sort of unicorn type of an artist out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, because this is your first feature animation project, I'm curious. You have hundreds and hundreds of shorts under your belt, directing animated shorts.
I'm really tired.
You're tired. What was the learning curve like going from shorts to a feature? Because this is the one opportunity that we have. We see character development in Porky and Daffy. And in their relationship, they actually grow up. They're forced to grow up a little bit.
Yeah.
We've got Petunia and Porky get a little closer, shall we say.
Yeah.
But what was this learning curve like for you to go from the short form cartoon to this feature?
Right. I was scared. I'd never done anything long form. The longest thing I've ever done before was about 20 minutes professionally. So prior to this, I'm a huge movie fan, though. I mean, like most people in this business are, but like I'm a snob. I have a big DVD collection that I'm very proud of, and Blu-ray, and I love Criterion, and I love old cinema. I'm a student of film, I just thought to myself, I'm going to dive into this. I'm not going to try to overthink it. I'm not going to try to change my process as far as now I'm going to do it the proper filmmaking, feature filmmaking way of making it. I'm going to throw myself into this, and I'm going to trust my gut. And I love my gut. My gut has done me well with my career, and even though it's getting a little bit big, being 45, but I believe that. I believe as an audience, like I think I mentioned, the audience member sitting yourself down there in the theater and imagining yourself there and feeling it out is really important. So I trust my instinct. I trust my crew. I trust the people I hire to help me tell a story. I respect their opinions. I ask opinions of all folks on the crew. You don't have to earn a certain job title to give me how you feel about something. I welcome that, and that's something I read about Tex Avery did. He would ask everyone in Termite Terrace if he thought something was funny, and he would adjust it. It didn't matter if you were Leon Schlesinger or the mailroom guy. He wanted to see what you thought about it, because that you're trying to entertain people. So that's sort of my philosophy. So yeah, trust my gut. I was scared. I didn't know. I'd never done it before, so I never knew if it was going to work or not, but I kept, you know, you watch this stuff over and over and over and over and over again while you're making it. So I always go, well, how many overs do I start getting tired of it? And I was like, well, I think after 10, if it lasts 10 without getting too tired of it, I think I'm okay.
Oh, my God.
And then everyone gets tired of anything watching it 10 times in a row. Then you need some space from it. You know, you need some time from it.
Something else that you've done, besides staying true to the 2D animation, the entire look, the feel, the emotion, you bring back Farmer Jim, who we've only seen once in 80 years.
Character, Farmer Jim.
So you're paying homage, Chuck Jones, that legacy comes in. But then you have Ruth Clampett voicing Maud the Waitress. What a lovely touch that pays homage to her father, Bob, who is a legend.
I have nothing but the utmost respect for Bob Clampett and everything he did as an artist and as a filmmaker and entertainer. I put him up with all of the greats, not only in animation history, but in film and animation history. And getting to meet Ruth and telling her about the film and telling her how much of a fan we are of her father's work and everything was really a pleasure. And then her agreeing to do the voice, she's like, I'm not an actress. I said, you can do it, Ruth. We'll get you to do it. And it was really, really special. And we named the diner Clampett in the movie. And there's a lot of Easter eggs of Clampett in there. Daffy Porky's piggy bank is the piggy bank from the Great Piggy Bank Robbery and many other things that we've thrown in there. For the hardcore fans, it was really special, and she told us some really fun stories about her dad, and he saved everything. And I got to tell you, there's some of his work being auctioned now at the Van Eaton Gallery out here, and I can't wait to go check it out. I'm really, Jerry Beck, one of the animation historian and friend, told me about it, and I can't wait to see some real Bob Clampett stuff in light with my own eyes. So,
well, hopefully you bring your own piggy bank. With you when you go to see all of it. I've got to ask you, a lot of people don't think about the music. The music is so important in this film, and it is timeless. You've got the classic Looney Tunes, but then you've got other music in there that's very timeless that does not jar us out of this wonderful, wonderful cacophony of animation that you've created. What were you looking for musically in this?
I had a relationship with Joshua Mosier, who's the composer of the film, and I knew he is an amazing, amazing talent, super, super one of a kind, natural genius. And I knew he's very versatile, and he can sort of do a ton playing with genre and tone and mood, and do the classic Carl Stalling Looney Tunes thing, but also, I wanted it to feel big like a movie and like a movie score. And I know our budget wasn't huge and we, you know, had a certain amount to work with, and he was able to do it. And he even did sort of the final credits joke of the sort of hip hop beats going on. I mean, he can do it all, and he gets it, easy to work with. And with that stuff, you know, I try to just find the best person possible that I as a fan appreciate, and I'll let them. I'm not musical, so I leave it up to them to sort of do it. But I talked about story and emotion and tone and how I wanted the audience to feel as the movie progressed and with each sequence, and we just did each sequence at a time. But yeah, Looney Tunes, right? Literally, tunes are the title, so it's half of what we're doing here is the music and sound. So it was really important that I'm just have Joshua on board.
Peter, an amazing job. I don't know how many more.
Thanks so much.
I don't know how many more times I'm going to watch it. I'm going to go to the theater and see it when it opens.
That's so nice of you to say. Thank you.
I have to, because Porky Pig Porky has never failed me in my entire life.
That's
so
right. he's a good guy.
And thank you for taking time to talk with me today, Peter. This has been a joy, and I hope we get to do it again for maybe a sequel.
A threequel. Three total. Yeah. Nice of you. Thanks for the kind words. I really appreciate it. Nice. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. You have a great rest of your evening.
You too.
And that was my exclusive interview with Peter Browngart discussing Looney Tunes, The Day the Earth Blew Up. I admit it. I am just loony for this Looney Tunes movie, and you will be too. I have loved Looney Tunes since I was a little girl, you know, over 60 years ago, and Porky Pig was always my fave. So I'm in Looney Pig heaven right now with this film. Looney Tunes, The Day the Earth Blew Up is in theaters this Friday, March 14th. Award-worthy on every level and not to be missed. And stay through the credits. Stay through the credits. You should do. I know I give you that mantra all the time, but the visuals continue through the credits and are a lot of fun. And that is all the time we have today. Two theatrical releases, two wonderful directors, two fantastic films. Go check them out. They're both in theaters. And until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.